I'm going to start Ronan Tynan, who you heard singing gloriously. Fantastic job. Well done, Ronan.
Thanks, Hayden.
That's kind Thank of got our hearts much. Going. Dr. Inga Russell, who, of course, is our Medal of Excellence winner. Dr. Pierce Lyons, who's the founder and owner of Alltech. We have Dr. Damien McLaughlin, who spoke, obviously, on the Game Changers. And Dr. Mark Lyons, who is director of production and director specifically of North America for Alltech at the moment. So we've got a great panel, gives us lots of opportunities to answer any good questions you have. I'd prefer not to call on names, so could somebody just indicate by pointing, by lifting their hand if they have a question to get us started? And also, could you just, for the purpose of the panel, just explain who you are and where you're from?
Okay, I'm Andrew Mouncey, editor of Feed Compounder magazine from the UK. I'm interested in the algae technology and the products that will be available, the timing, and will they be available in Europe over what time scale?
Okay, I think I'm going to let Dr. Lyon start with that.
Yes.
Algae products.
Algae. Andrew, excellent question. First of all, as a sort of a premise to algae, when we work with yeast, we work with maybe 40 strains, 50, maybe 60 at a stretch. When we work with algae, we have as many as 800,000 strains. And so the ability of algae to get involved in bioremediation, picking up things like heavy metals, toxins, and so forth, is phenomenal. On the other hand, it requires a number of things, and one of the most important thing it requires, of course, is carbon dioxide. And depending on whether it's so-called heterotrophic or autotrophic, in other words, whether it needs sunlight or doesn't need sunlight, again, that opens up a myriad of opportunities. But let me give you some ideas. We're working with the flue gases from some of the coal-fired boilers around here, the generating stations. And we take those flue gases and we put in a certain type of algae to take out the toxins at the beginning, and then we have that pure carbon dioxide coming on through, and then we have another algae grows on that. And we end off with something which has possibly got about 40, 50, 60% fat. That could be converted easily into biodiesel. Equally, if we're looking for an algae which has a high protein content, we would select a different strain, and we can get up maybe 60, 70, 80%. But let's say we're looking for fish oil, and that's a little bit closer to our requirements. There's a million tons of fish oil produced on the earth, in the world. Fish oil, one of the things, I don't know if you went to see our facility yesterday, but as you walked in, surely it reminded you of being at the seaside. I mean, you could smell the fish, you could smell the seaweed. We could very easily make a substitute for fish oil. Whether we could make it at the right price yet remains to be seen. So from fish oil substitutes, from fish meal substitutes, from novel proteins to biodiesel, it is a myriad of applications. We will start off with 10,000 tons of algae. That 10,000 tons will be processed in such a way as to go into aquaculture. That's what we see as the initial big target. The second part of your question is, would we put something into Europe? We have a major fermentation plant in Serbia, one of the biggest in Europe. It would be very, very easy for us, in fact, to put an addendum, to put an addition onto that to produce algae. So I believe, yes, we will be producing in Europe. And those will be some of the products.
Yes, Simon.
Dr. Simon Sheen. Dr. Lyons, point one of your game changers was we have to get off using corn.
Yes.
And use fiber. Ruminants, yes. How do you anticipate having a supplement, or how do you anticipate replacing corn for monogastrics?
Yeah, excellent question. And so how do we use fiber for the monogastric and, of course, for the ruminant? And even on the ruminant, we can help, because we're still only getting about 80% utilization. So there's still a lot of work to be done there. But on the monogastric side, what we have to do is move forward. There may be some pre-processing steps. You know, Simon, you could ask the very same question as to when will we be using fiber to make fuel ethanol as opposed to using corn. You'll get 90% of the energy from fiber that you get from 100, that you get from, sorry, let me rephrase that. If you got 100 units of energy from corn, you'd get 90 units of energy from fiber. And the way we do it, in fact, is it's too simplistic to say you'll put one or two enzymes together, cellulase. You have to use those complex systems which are present in nature, and hence I try to give the example of the termites. They do it, they chew it up, they break it up, and they allow a fungus to then take it to the next step. That's how you do it. You're well aware that we're doing some work with Professor Devagouda, excuse me, in India. And my mandate to him was I didn't want one single grain of corn in his poultry diets. I have to tell you this morning that no, we are not getting the chickens to market weight in 42 days. We're getting them to market weight in 60 days, but they're only using fiber and SSF.
Can I extend that, Inga? One of the leading broiler companies I visited used the phrase that DDGs, dried distillers grains, are no longer an alternative. They're a fundamental part of the diet. We have to find alternatives to corn. Have you any insights? What other feeding stocks could we use? Have you any insights as to what else could we be feeding?
Rather than corn?
Yeah.
All the sugar cane. There's just, it's unlimited. Everything that at the moment we're not using that's discarded and that's just going into compost, we could be using. It's totally unlimited.
So we just have to think completely differently about what
totally
we're doing.
Totally different way of thinking. But there's just no limit to what we could use.
Okay, any other questions? Yes. So just repeat it, Nigel, please.
Nigel Horrocks from the UK. Question for Damien. You highlighted that the major game changers in the livestock sector are primarily outside Europe and North America. Is that because management in those countries and those areas have lost their hunger or are being strangulated by red tape?
Didn't catch the last part, are they?
Or are being strangulated by red tape and bureaucracy.
I think when you have... I've done some work in Pakistan in the poultry sector and looked quite a bit at China also. I think when firms there have ambition, what they can see is no boundaries whatsoever. But those boundaries tend to come to the fore fairly quickly. I think what's different about the developing world organisations is that they refuse to allow anything to get in their way. And I think government is more positively supportive of them. I don't think there's any question about that in China. I don't think there's any question of that in the Asian, the sort of far Asian countries whatsoever. But I think the business model that applies in most Western firms, whether that's in food and agribusiness or whether it's in anything else, is busted. And what the Asian firms, South American firms, what African firms are doing today is rethinking how we should do business. Taking into account the constraints that they actually have. I'm not certain it's a red tape issue per se. I think their success is more a rethinking of their own problems, if you like.
Yeah, Dr. Lyons, travelling around the world, what are, so to speak, from a business point of view, the game changers? What's going to make food and agribusiness companies successful?
I think, following on what Damien said, I think it's the embracing of new technology. I think it's seeing no barriers, or if there are barriers, going around those barriers. I'm always reminded of the case of the Saguna company over there, excuse me, in India. And here's a company who, that's what you get when you're the moderator all morning. But here's a company, and I tell the story of them. Two boys going to school. And as they went to school, their parents were teachers. And as they came to graduate, the teachers, the parents, said to the two boys, here's what you will not do. You will not go to university. Because when you go to university, you're going to get knowledge and you're going to block all that imagination. So instead, they gave them and I don't know what the figure was, 250 or 300 chickens. And today they're a $1 billion company, and they're growing and growing. And they embrace new technologies so fast. And they go about it as a scientist should go about it, that when you have something, and Inga, I learned this from you, when there's something you're going to test, you're going to test. But if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. I mean, your knowledge base is now that much further on. I think we have to rethink what we're doing in nutrition. And I see that in Thailand, and I see that in China, and I see that in all these other countries. I may get myself shot for this, but one of the things that I do when I go around the world, Aidan, and I see the audience that we are addressing, and I'm purposely not looking at the journalists now, and if the audience is under 30, 35, I know I'm with a progressive group. And if the audience is on the other side, I know I am not in a progressive group. I think we need to make nutrition a little more exciting, and certainly you pick that up, don't you, when you go to these countries. And not just nutrition, it's business.
Okay, a little dispiriting for those over 35, like myself. Anyway, Clayton.
Clayton Gill with Feedstuffs, also well over 35, and happy about it too, frankly.
Me too. Well, we don't have any choice, let's face it.
No, we move forward. Speaking of forward, certainly a large part of what the feed industry has traditionally done is to be a recycling industry. We recycle, we repurpose, we reuse. And one of those challenges when you do that, of course, with these molecules is to keep them safe. And on the technical side, Pearson, maybe Mark and Inga, perhaps you can comment on how to keep those molecules safe. You'd mentioned the heavy metals particularly. There'd be lots of other things out there, the PCBs and the dioxins, all that sort of material we do not want in the food chain. Moving forward, how do we keep those molecules we're going to recycle and reuse, how do we keep them safe?
Okay. Dr. Lyons, Inga, which one of you'd like to start?
That's a really hard one. I don't know if we can ever keep them out. But if we know they're in there, okay, then we have the ability to... Yeah. I don't know whether we can ever totally keep them out. I think we have to accept they're going to be there. But we do have the technology and the smarts, once we know they're there, to figure out how to take them out before we feed them to the animal. So it's just another step to me that we have to be put in the process.
I think it's a re-education. Yes, the PCBs are going to be there. Yes, the dioxins are going to be there. They've been there for a long, long time, maybe there for hundreds and hundreds of years, and we're still around. And nature has a wonderful way of being able to handle many of these things. And alluding back to the question on algae has an incredible ability to handle these things. Think about it. You have an atmosphere where temperatures are in excess of 100 degrees centigrade. You have an atmosphere where all you have basically is carbon dioxide and, Carl, I guess some methane. And yet this incredible microorganism was able and is able to survive under those conditions. And without its survival, you and I, whether we be 35 or 55 or 95, would not be living in the world we're living in today. For the feed industry, I think we have to embrace more in our education, more emphasis, perhaps, Carl, on microbiology as much as nutrition, because it's a biological situation we're dealing with. It's a microbiological situation we're dealing with. I don't know, Carl, if our director of research would like to comment on that.
Yes, your question is very good. You've got two different issues as I see it. One of them is first detection. And one of the things that's really going to scare us in the future is we get better at detecting some of these materials. We're going to find out where they are. Now, that's going to give us alternatives. You know, where do we put that material? Where's the safest part of that? The other side of that then becomes, what are you going to do to evaluate risk? And that's truly the question. It's not matter whether the materials are there, as Dr. Lyons said. They're going to be there. You have to decide, is that a risk? Is that a long-term risk, short-term risk? How are you going to do that? And then direct your efforts to do that. The neat thing about the biology we're using today, though, suggests that there are things we can do to mediate or mitigate those problems. And that's going to be the important thing as we move down the road. Can we detoxify? There are ways to take care of that problem. Can we move them from some place that they're dangerous to a place where they're safe? And we've been doing that with mycotoxins now for 15, 20 years by taking them and putting them in the feces rather than in the animal. So there's lots of potential to change that. But I think you're absolutely right. As we move forward, we just started this last 3 months with a new program in our laboratories that will actually detect mycotoxins at probably tenfold greater level than we've ever seen them before. And we can see about somewhere around 40 different mycotoxins in one test. That scares you because you become very sensitive to what's there and you can see things you never saw before. Now we've got to mitigate that. But we do have some tools to do that.
Thank you, Steve. Atkins, Watt, you had a question?
Yeah, I'm Steve Atkins with Watt Media Group, and my question mainly is for Damien, I guess. You've traveled, obviously, extensively in China and the Middle East, as you've indicated, and two of the companies you talked about today in your presentation, which I thought was fantastic, are based in China. And as you're probably aware, there's a huge food safety initiative going on here in the U.S., FSMA, and perhaps even in Western Europe. What kinds of initiatives are those companies undertaking in the area of food safety?
It seems to me that, thanks for the question, it seems to me that the, KFC in particular, I think, in China has put food safety absolutely entirely at the center of their strategy. And I think that's been something they did pretty much from the start. And what they have done is effectively to reinvent the supply chain. So they have taken particular poultry firms and basically changed their systems entirely in terms of the right kinds of chicks, the right kind of parent stock, and so on. Everything absolutely is traceable. They built a supply chain to allow them to carry it safely around the country, and they have a KFC in China have a supply chain which is second only to the Red Army in terms of its capabilities, absolutely extraordinary capabilities. Liu He, the company I mentioned, has about 500 scientific people in a center not dissimilar to Altec's scientific center. And it seems to me that just from visiting there and what people are doing there, is they all seem to be US-educated scientists, UK-educated scientists, all Chinese nationals who have come back with the best possible ideas. I spent about an hour when I visited the Liu He plant where they showed me their machinery. And they just got rooms and rooms of machinery all to do all of the tests, which I'm not a scientific expert, but I'm sure Carl could have engaged very, very strongly in terms of, well, are they doing every possible test here? Interestingly, they use it to do two things. One is to absolutely guarantee the safety of their product, and also to reduce their costs, which I thought was really very interesting. I visited a company which is a big customer of Altec called K&N's Poultry in Pakistan in March, and they have also put safety absolutely entirely at the center of their business. And they have been hugely successful. They work with American parent and grandparent stock. They have their own grandparent stock farms. They buy all of their machinery from the best international suppliers. They educate their senior management team in the U.S. And the win that they get from that is when KFC goes to Pakistan, they call on K&N's. And when Hardee's goes to Pakistan, they call on K&N's. And when Nando's goes to Pakistan, they call on K&N's. And all of those firms are there. And they really build on this safe opportunity that these special game-changing organizations have. So I think, for me, the really interesting thing, if you sort of look across the board, is that, you know, the absolute leading organizations in these countries have taken the best ideas that we have in the developed world, and they're just doing something different with them, and I think what they're doing is very, very interesting.
Mark Lyons, you had the opportunity, you've lived in Brazil and Serbia, and you spent a lot of time in Mexico, so you probably have some insights into this. Do you think that the standards we have in the Western world are different, or how do you think the developing world is embracing these ideas?
Well, I was just reflecting as Damien was talking about it, and I thought if I brought a group of experts from Europe and North America, and I said, let's talk about food safety, I'd probably mainly have people from the regulatory area. I'd have governmental types of people. I might have some journalists. If I was to do the same type of thing in Asia, I think I'd probably have people from companies. I'd have industry leaders. I'd have business leaders. I'd have a good group of scientific thinkers in both aspects. But I think that's a subtle change, and I find the same in Latin America, that it tends to be the businesses that are leading the way and not necessarily the government. And I think the other point that was made earlier, I think there's a subtle difference, and when we see those five game-changing companies, they have a different attitude. You know, they are adopting technology, but they also see things in terms of partnerships. And I think that's a very, very important point that comes out. It isn't an adversarial relationship with the government. It's a partnership. And if it's KFC, you know, they're looking at things. If it's good for China, it's good for KFC. And I think that's a very big difference probably between their colleagues over here in the States. So I think that absolutely, I think the standards are the same more and more. I think we're seeing, we're much, much further. I don't think we thought we would be here 10, even 5 years ago, there's almost a global standard that you know, food should be of a high quality anywhere in the world. And I think that's just going to continue.
Margaret, you had a question?
Margaret Buranin from Business Lexington. I'd like to ask Dr. Lyons about his fifth idea, the farm of the future. How long before those become the farm of the reality, say here in Kentucky?
Farm of the future, how long?
Excellent question. If I was to listen to the 62,000 children that came through, they would have it done tomorrow or the next day because they see no barriers. But there is a reality check. And the reality check says that if you look at the individual pieces, the wind power is there, the solar panels are there, the SSF is there, we're using it. We have a plant in Mexico. We have a pilot plant in Nicholasville. So most of the pieces are there. And so I'd be very surprised if in 2 or 3 years that you don't see something like that. I know that when we brought some of our governmental people through at the time of the Games, they were very keen, in fact, to build a pilot plant and have us build a pilot plant just to show that it could be done. So I'd say 2 years, you're going to see it. You know, I'm always amazed at how adventurous and how entrepreneurial farmers are. And, you know, anybody who takes a raw material or takes something and puts it in the ground and comes back months later and then, okay, it comes up and it's not eaten by the insects and so forth, and you get a crop. You know, these people are used to taking risks, calculated risks. So I think, in fact, if we laid it out properly, and I think meetings like this and show them the possibilities, I think you may be surprised. 1-2 years, we will have something like that. Actually, I would go even further. I'd say we have a moral obligation, even as a company like Alltech. I'm looking at you, and I'm hoping Carl Dawson is listening. I think we have a moral obligation and a scientific responsibility to put such a unit in and put it in quickly. And if he can do that in his budget and reduce his budget every year, then he can get on with it. But it's going to happen quickly.
Just in the interest of time, could I have a good last question? Yes. We've got two, do we?
Yeah, they've been holding for a while.
Good, all right.
Kim McMillan, I'm a freelancer in several different areas, agriculture, equestrian, and general. My question is for Dr. Tynan. I learned quite a bit about you today, and congratulations on your award. I would like to know, you've obviously met and succeeded in several different areas, several different challenges. What's next for you? And also, quickly, do you still practice medicine?
Yes, I actually do practice medicine in Ireland. I don't practice it here unless I've been asked to look at some kind of radiographs or MRIs on shoulders and stuff like that that I'd have seen in the past, usually associated with hurlers and footballers, not the baseball boys that you'd see over here. What's in my future? I suppose in some respects, the area of television certainly intrigues me, and there has been talks of kind of doing a kind of a Ronan rant show, which is a bit scary, or should I use that word? The other thing is I'm also in talks with a TV company about doing what they call a masterclass show for people in their 50s, in the older, or in the middle, my age group, that people who would aspire to be singers at this level could have the opportunity to sing.
Can I apply?
Of course you can. I'm actually saying this that I'm hoping that you'll come as be one of the clients.
Guinea pig?
Oh, no. No, guinea pig is not the right word. I think you'd enjoy it, Dr. Lyons. You'd enjoy the message. But, I mean, that's something I think there's no limit to a person's dreams. I think there was a great philosopher that said, dream and your dream will fall short. I like that idea. And this company, Alltech, represents so many amazing dreams in the area of nutrition and agriculture that Dr. Lyons makes things happen, and that's a great thing. And I was very blessed to have two great parents. And my mother never doubted that I wouldn't do something with my life, but she instilled that will, and I think for some reason that will is coming through. Thank you for your question.
May I add to that? Because he's been a little modest. The University of Kentucky has decided to, in fact, take him on, and he will be a visiting professor at the University of Kentucky. And he'll have a number of students. But he will be taken on it has been agreed. It has been agreed all the way up to the president of the university that he'll be joining the faculty as a visiting professor. And I think that's incredible. I think it's incredible for Kentucky. And look forward to having you come back on a regular basis, Ronan.
Well, I tell you what, it's my pleasure. And thank you for the opportunity. It's been a joy to be with you and Mark. And as I said, Alltech is a family. And family sticks together, works together, and then you get success. And you're walking proof of that, my friend.
Good. Nice one. One more question. Yes, please, Clay.
This is for Ronan, too. I'm glad we got you in the conversation here. I was just going to ask, based on a lot of the topics, the kind of work that Alltech does, what is your game-changing advice to farmers? Kind of like this cowboy in the black hat back here, for example.
Well, you know what? I'm a farmer.
And if you'd like to sing your answer, that'd be okay.
No, it's all right. No, I'll do that later. I think we're going to have some kind of an exciting experience later on tonight. But I'm a farmer's son. I was brought up on a farm. We did dairying. We did. We're a mixed farm. We witnessed also, as growing up, we witnessed effects of tuberculosis and brucellosis in a herd, and we saw how it affects economically a family and how family has to pull together. When you were talking about trying to deal with molecules that can contaminate food and all the rest, I was thinking, is there a way you could put a ligand in there that would bind this particular molecule and pull it out? But then I'm not going to venture, Dr. Russell, into your area. But I think that farming is the mainstay of the world. Agriculture is what will keep this whole world of ours alive. Ireland as a country is suffering an awful lot from a major economic hit. But agriculture will bring Ireland back, and the people will become cohesive. And that's what people have to remember. It's natural resources, it's the soil, it's what we cultivate and what we grow will give the great strength to the world. And using the great people in Alltech and all over the world and the great scientists to analyze and work out what's the best way to get a great crop growing, what's the best way to get the cow to yield the best milk. That's how we will step forward in the future and go for agriculture.
And sing to the cows and they'll be happy.
Listen, when I used to sing to the cows, the milk yield was good and there was a low bacterial count. As my father used to say, sing to the girls and they'll be happy.
Okay, that's a great note to finish on. Our panel will be still here for a couple of minutes. We're a little tight on time, so I'll ask you to thank them very much. Thank you all for being here. Thanks again.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.